Thanks for tuning in to the HR Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Lucinda Carney. The HR Uprising is focused on helping forward-thinking people professionals deliver real lasting value in their organisations. I'm a chartered psychologist, speaker and trainer, and recently authored the best-selling business book, How to Be a Change Superhero. My day job is founder and CEO of software and training business Actus. This gives me the opportunity to work with other businesses like yours. We are focused on building a better workplace for people wherever they are located, with the help of our performance, learning and talent management software and our training and consultancy services. Every week on the podcast, I will be covering different topics and challenges, joined by relevant experts and real-life people professionals. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really hope you enjoy and get value from this week's episode. Hello and welcome to a very special HR Uprising podcast episode. So this is actually our 150th episode. Who would have thought? How many 3 years ago that we would have got this far? So thank you to everyone who's listened along the way, new and long-standing listeners. And I felt that I had to mark this episode in some way. And I'm marking it by bringing on a guru, with no doubt that there's someone that you know that I should be embarrassed that I've called her that. But the reality is, Linda Holbeck is joining me today. And anyone who's been in the CIPD or done academic study in psychology or HR will definitely have heard of Linda, because she is a prolific author and researcher. She's done more than 60 research reports, Linda, I believe you've done. You've co-authored or authored 16 books, numerous content out there. So I'm really delighted to have Linda. So Linda, so she's a recognised thought and practice leader. If you haven't heard of her, she's been voted one of HR's most influential on more than one occasion, I'm sure. Previously, she was CIPD's Director of Research and Policy. She's now Adjunct Professor at Imperial College London and Visiting Professor at four other UK universities. I mentioned the 60 research reports, but if you wanted to look into her forthcoming books, her latest books, not latest singular books, she's got three latest books, some of which she authored personally, some of which are follow-on editions, but they are The Agile Organisation, Organisational Development, A Practitioner's Guide for OD and HR. And I know that the OD element I find particularly interesting with your co-author that you worked that one with, and Aligning HR and Business Strategy. If you want to know more about that, because there's so much I could say, we wouldn't have time for the podcast, obviously go to the HR Uprising website. So when Linda and I were chatting earlier in the week, wondering what's the best thing for us to focus on, really, because there are clearly, with somebody with so much knowledge, there's loads of things we could focus on. It was, where do we filter it down? So we thought we'd start by focusing broadly around what we think the key HR strategies that we should be prioritizing in 2022, because life is different from what it was when some of your books came out, Linda. As I'm saying, it's moving all the time. So I was interested really to start really and ask you, why would you say it's more important than ever for HR to think strategically in this current climate?
Well, Lucinda, as you just said, I think we've lived in the last few years through some extraordinary times that are now becoming normal. And to a large extent, if we just react to things and keep on doing what we've always done, we won't even get what we always had before. It'll be worse. So we've got to adapt and move. And that involves looking ahead, trying to get to grips with what's happening. And if we just took a few headlines, you know, just from recent past, we know that the underlying trends are to do with that technological advance that's changing the world of work and business dramatically. We know it's driving a sort of consumer revolution underneath it all. We're also in a period of massive political and economic instability. So it makes planning and conventional running of businesses difficult. And we know that innovation is going to be required everywhere if you're just going to keep ahead of the changing marketplace. And that's not even to mention the great black swan event that we've been enjoying, ha ha ha, living through the last couple of years, i.e. the pandemic. And that, it's variously called the great accelerator, that's a McKinsey term. in that all those trends I was just alluding to have been accelerated by the pandemic, as we found just in 2020 to 21, the first lockdowns, HR in particular moved mountains to get whole workforces suddenly working from home.
Absolutely.
The Microsoft, head of Microsoft, was saying, you know, the kind of developments that we were previously taking 2 years to do, we managed in 2 months. So there is something about the experiences that we've had that shows that not only can we do strategic transformation and make change stick, but we need to, because change and the need for change is ongoing. And we need to get ahead of the curve, not simply have to react to the next wave of whatever the changes are, as much as we can. That's why a strategic view is really, really important. And HR proved it's capable of doing that.
Yes, sorry. And it wasn't just working from home, was it? It was furlough pay and you know, all sorts of things, terms that we'd never heard of, managing resource, etc. So before perhaps we go on to those 4 points, because we identified that we were going to chat around, there's so many areas we could look at about maybe how we could get ahead of the curve. We'll focus in on four topics. I just thought I'd reflect back at you. What occurred to me when you were mentioning those points of tech, the changing world, political and economic environment, the pandemic, that if I'd been talking to a group of HR people, let's say 3 years ago, and let's remember that in terms of being thinking strategically, that has been a criticism or a challenge leveled at HR professionals for quite a long time, that they've been challenged that they should be thinking more strategically as you become more senior. And if I'd have said, how do you think more strategically? I'd been probably saying you need to align with the business strategy. So you should be putting in interventions in line with recruitment or attrition, or you know, if you are going into a new market, how do you upskill people? So it'd be aligning with business strategy. Now that's not wrong, but it strikes me that suddenly we've got to go even further out. We've got to be more externally focused, because all of those things you describe, the political and economic circumstances, it's strategic with bells on. It's thinking wider and outside of the organisation. I don't know. I'm just reflecting that back at you. I don't know whether you'd comment on that.
Yeah, no, I fully agree, because on the one hand, I think generically HR functions are incredibly busy. They always have been and probably always will be. And they've also been encouraged in the last 20 years or so to focus more on or heavily on best practice, you know, learning from each other the latest talent management technique or whatever, and trying to apply it in their context. Whereas what you're talking about and where I'm coming from, I suppose, more is the notion that if there is such a thing as a best fit, it's only temporary. And best fit is about what is specific about your organisation, its situation, what it's trying to do, and what you need, therefore, in terms of the workforce, the ways of working, the kinds of leadership and management you might need to get the best out of that workforce, and to, you know, bridge the technology people divide as much as possible. And I think now these big events that we're still living through have been a salutary lesson to exactly what you're reflecting, which is that HR can't afford anymore to really look to a copybook for, you know, what's good practice and how can I apply it? Yes, do some of that, but do it in the context of what specifically, and looking not just around me now, but looking ahead, where is my business, my organisation going? And what are some of the risks and the opportunities out there? And be part of that business conversation, because otherwise you can be planning for a workforce that you don't actually need in the form that it has now. So I agree with you. I think it is a big picture as well as make it practical.
Yes, and it's quite scary when you think about it like that, because as you say, a copybook, anything that was written 3 years ago may not be relevant, and you've got to apply it to your context and think, and you know, no one knows the actual answer, but what's our best answer right now? And I suppose strategy, you sometimes say strategy has very long term. You might have a strategy or direction, what we think it is, but we've got to be prepared to reflect on it and be agile, maybe an overused term, but be prepared to tweak it. and adjust things and see whether we're getting the results we thought we would, because there is no tried and tested formula. Probably there never was, but yeah. Less so than ever thought before. So yeah. So it's going on from those points. So when we spoke earlier, and you've mentioned technology a few times there as being a key area, there are so many agendas that we could look in on, but we agreed that we would perhaps explore, in terms of key strategies or for areas to focus on in 2022 and beyond, we'd explore technology and how to get beyond admin. We thought we'd explore the talent agenda, employee engagement, and leadership style. So no small ask there. There's four major meaty topics. I realise we'll just scratch the surface. But let's start with the tech and beyond admin. What do you think about how we can better embrace tech and, I guess, use the data that it can offer us?
Yeah. Well, I think it is a key enabler of the kind of strategic approach that we're talking about. It's also an enabler of agility, which I think is called for now more than ever. You know, whatever we're doing, it needs to be accurate, it needs to be speedily delivered, it has to be personalized, and ideally it should be transparent and be the basis of good decision making. So obviously there is a huge drive from many suppliers to help people transform their HR operations, and to a large extent that drive is penetrating the market, but there's still, for budget and other reasons, some reluctance out there for HR to embrace some of these technologies. And I would encourage people to really look closely at what their business might need in that way, and get data savvy, get tech savvy, get digitally enabled as a team, so that you can start to see how this data that can be generated can be used to help the business address some really key strategic issues for the business, not only for the workforce. And that's the point, that it's not any old data will do. There are certain things that should be thought of in terms of what can we do with this to develop data that can help the business move forward? Because 2022, everybody's predicting, seems to be growth everywhere. Well, let's hope everyone's right. All these predictions. And those businesses and organisations that are going to be successful will have most of their ducks in a row in order to be able to respond to the opportunities or to make opportunities. And having a data-informed HR practice that allows people to get on with their jobs and do them better and faster, and decisions to be made that are better made decisions, is a key enabler of the business to achieve that kind of competitive breakthrough that they want to do. So I think it does mean that really we have to embrace the idea that as an HR function, we've got to evolve, and as fast, if not faster, than other bits of the business, ideally, get help where you can. Because yeah. Without that, you've not got the time or the space to play your part in broader strategic transformations, which I think are key to HR's added value in this very changing world. So you've got to act agile by embracing this stuff, learning, iterating through it, working as teams, working as integrated teams with other people who are moving the business forward in different ways, and really land improved, better, fit for purpose processes, policies, actions, decisions, in a way that doesn't take 5 years.
Yeah.
And the good thing is people have proved they can do that, even with limited technology. So what can you do with technological support? And I work a lot with universities, and I can think of one or two that have been, you know, traditionally HR has not been well provided for in budgetary terms for technology in that sector. But I know one or two have really embraced robotics in their and automation of their back office functions, if you like, the operational side. And it's making a huge difference. One of them has got their bot is called HR Herbert. And Herbert of course, because it's fueled by artificial intelligence as well, gets better and better and better at being able to provide personalized, accurate responses to just about everything. So in a way, that's some slight exaggeration, of course, but the point about technology, if it's clearly reflective of machine learning, it means that people are learning too, and HR are learning what they can do with the freed up space that they now have, what it means in terms of their contribution, and it's a positive story.
It's quite hard a lot of the time for HR with, if they are still stuck with very basic paper-based systems, or the tech that they've got is basically is administrative. So it's a database of you know, self-serve, who works in the company and what their personal details are, as opposed to more strategic data that we're talking about here, that you can demonstrate value and change and it's real time. And I think that's one that it is a bit chicken and egg to actually demonstrate a business case if you haven't got the data in the first place. And I completely agree that when I look at any other area, finance, sales, not marketing, any other area in a business, generally HR is the poor relation in terms of the investment in tech that they're able to access. But I mean, the robots, it sounds really exciting. I'd love to know more about that. If you were, if people were listening out there and thinking, where would you start in terms of the sort of strategic data that you'd want to be able to get? Because everyone's got to start somewhere and obviously they haven't got the history. Obviously I can see you get real-time data, which helps, and they can be more responsive. What practically, or what would be, could you give us two or three examples of how tech data would be particularly helpful in an HR department and add value back to the business that you recommend people looked into being able to gather?
Well, on the one hand, you know, most organisations do some sort of employee engagement survey. Arguably, you could do fewer of those if you were making more of the ones that you did carry out, and you were able to really deduce, especially in the thing we're going to talk about shortly, which is talent, what are our key risks here, as well as what are the pain points for people, and what can we do to address those? And even without the most encyclopedic survey data, one can, if you're doing it not every 5 minutes, but more frequently in areas that are important to the business, to understand what can be done to demonstrate visibly, we've heard you, we want to make a difference here. Now let's work out together what that difference can be, can look like. I think bit by bit, HR can be seen to be making a real difference to in ways that the business might help. If you go further and say, well, actually, we could really do with looking ahead at where our business is going, what kind of workforce we need. You know, we're investing heavily in technology over here. We're having shared service operations all over the place in all sorts of areas, some of which are offshored or whatever. What kind of workforce do we need? Do we need a fully employed workforce, or is it more contractual, or is it, you know, done through third parties? So, you know, actually leading some of the discussions with executives and others to really understand what are the implications of our business strategy, not just our current one, but what's likely to follow as best one can see, so that you can start to think about, okay, well, we're going to have real shortages of those kinds of skills. So what do we do now to try and build relations with the right kind of talent suppliers, or, you know, the right universities or colleges where we might be able to source future.
Or grow our own, or you have to start early to do that.
So I think even without the best technology in the world, it's the thought, the conversation, the translation of that into the so what's. That I think allow HR to show that they're equipping the organisation for what it's trying to do. They're also helping the organisation mitigate key risks, because even if you're going fully technologically driven, at some point you're going to be tailing off your current workforce, but you need them right now, and you need to be doing the right things for that workforce right now. So it's not a, okay, let's not bother anymore.
Yeah, it's a juggling act, isn't it? And you often you need to keep things like legacy skills. If your technology can't just like move all the way over, that can also be an issue. So it's interesting because we're naturally moving into talent there, aren't we? Just before we go on, I just wanted to understand in case other people are feeling curious, because I am. So HR Burt, so what was it? What is he or the bot doing for? How is he helping that particular organisation?
Well, it's essentially it's like an internet-based intranet-based helpline, but it goes far further than that. Yes, and it's employee self-service and manager self-service, but it's also brilliant at producing plenty of data, plenty of trend data, plenty of insight that can be drilled, again, around things like how responses are, you know, what are the kinds of issues that people are concerned about? So that, again, HR is better equipped to say, oh, crumbs, we can see that this issue is starting to bubble up. And in a sector which is potentially quite disturbed in terms of industrial relations or employee relations, it allows for conversations to take place before there's a big bust up sort of thing. Right. So it becomes a sort of all-purpose tool in the end, where people can access accurate information, but it's also digesting some of the issues, so that
putting the themes about what people are almost search terms. So if I was saying, what's my pension plan, or would it be as more transactional stuff that I'd be asking? It's pulling those terms out. I'm trying to work out, what would you type in as an organization? You know, is my manager good or not? You're not going to ask that, are you? It's going to be more about HR benefits or holiday or those sorts of things, I would have thought.
Yes, I mean, it's only been going a couple of years, if that, but it started very much in those sort of, you know, transactional need to know type things around the basics. But gradually it's, you know, it's looking at, well, we've got more and more people looking at pay issues. We've got more and more people concerned about mental well-being.
So the themes are starting to come through.
And that then allows, okay, well, let's look in more detail at the kinds of issues without blowing people's anonymity or anything. It allows the issues to be looked at and understood in more detail so that the conversation can then take place.
And you can provide stuff that's more useful. So it's not, you know, wellbeing with your mental first aiders, mental health first aiders or whatever. You can look to respond to the things that people are asking about more frequently.
Yeah, and again, it's quite a, you know, it's an enabler of conversations between people as well. So it acts as a sort of social media platform as well. So, you know, there's a lot of things that people can then do for each other and do for themselves, you know, in parts of the provision. So I think it's just one example.
And you don't have to go to, and I think that's it's important. I'm really curious in it that's kind of quite a sophisticated level of things. But what we're really saying is, let's move beyond just the operational admin, just having a database. Let's look at what else we can do and what that data is telling us and how we can use it to be useful to the business in terms of making decisions.
Yes. And whether it's, you know, exaggerating to say, well, that's the strategic use of data. I think it's certainly part of the scanning and sensing part of strategy.
Yes.
That we can more obviously and without much effort on our part pick up on issues that previously we'd have had to spend oodles on expensive surveys to do. It doesn't mean it replaces surveys, but it does allow corroborative evidence and it allows agility. You know, so that there can be some iterative work done around some of those issues and see whether that makes a difference on them.
Absolutely. So it's kind of going all the time as well. So you're taking, but at the end of the day, exactly like your point about engagement surveys, though, it's all very well having the data. What we're really saying is being prepared to do something with the data and looking to apply it. And that moves us on to our talent agenda. And I think this is an interesting one at the moment because we've got terms like the Great Resignation, whether that's real or otherwise. I've talked about that with Mervyn Dinnan recently. You've got talent acquisition, talent retention, talent development, you name, there's all sorts of things we could talk about. Where would you go with talent? That's a bit of a loaded question, actually. How would you start to decide which to prioritise, I guess?
Well, it's, again, as you say, it's a vast topic. But I mean, just to, again, pick up the theme of talent shortages, just thinking in the UK, as an example, there was a national statistical survey in September of last year, 2021, that pointed out that there were 1.2 million job vacancies and ever diminishing unemployment levels. In September, it was down to 4.5% and it's going down further. So in other words, obviously, it's a very tight labour market. And if those job vacancies are for real, as clearly has proved to be the case in sectors such as hospitality, care, to a large extent in health as well. You know, haulage, you know, road, lorry drivers and so on. Those are just some of the sectors that are struggling to get staff with particular skills or approaches. And then, you know, there are lots of IT companies that are really struggling as well. So in certain fundamental areas, we're lacking and consequently, you know, risks are growing. And I think the Great Resignation, it's a very good McKinsey phrase again, but I think I'm also interested in things that the Road Haulage Association calls it a leaky bucket, where not only can they not get enough new people trained up to be lorry drivers because of all sorts of bureaucratic requirements and so on and so forth, and here not mentioning the Brexit word at all. The issue is that people have discovered during the pandemic particularly that actually some of the jobs they were doing beforehand, they don't want to go back to. They're off furlough, but they don't want to go back to doing, you know, the same old, same old. So the leaky bucket is constantly trying to replenish the bucket. And at the same time, you've got people pouring out the bottom holes of the bucket. And in many
healthcare
cases,
healthcare is exactly the same, isn't it? If you look at healthcare, we're training up midwives. You know, we can't train them up fast enough to stop, you know, stop them leaving. So there's a whole sort of other issue there.
Yeah. So there's a whole range of issues that are to do with topping up the bucket. You know, the recruitment bits, and you know, one of the things that many companies are trying to do is re-recruit people who've already retired. You know, so the demographics of the aging workforce, et cetera, in some ways could help, you know, if people are willing to come back into the workforce. And at the other end of the spectrum, you've got companies like Compass, which of course is a massive company. But in the UK, they've got an industry academy based in the West Midlands, which is an area with relatively low social mobility and fewer employment opportunities. So they're hoping to get more and more people trained up through their academy and employed where they live to, you know, as part of the levelling up agenda, I suppose. And they're using techniques that are not revolutionary, but using things like TikTok to target students during holidays to come and work on flexible contracts and so on, all the time thinking, how are we going to build this labour force back up to the strength it needs to be to do the kind of work we've got? So, you know, on the one hand, you've got recruitment issues, and that is a huge problem for many sectors. So other areas are to think of, well, how do we retain the people? And that's where much of it is to do with investing in the people you've got. And that's the whole range of things to do with upskilling, reskilling, providing people with the opportunity to move around if yours is a large enough organisation. And ironically, I was looking at a survey just yesterday which suggested that large organisations on this issue of shortage, they are trying to recruit use recruitment as a means of solving the leaky bucket syndrome. So they want people with just the right kind of skills to fit their niche and pay them well to come in. Small to medium-sized organisations, which you'd think would have fewer opportunities for people to develop, are tending to move people around their organisation and give them development opportunities and invest in things like digital skills and so on, so that people are gradually increasing their capability for doing other jobs, preferably from the employer's point of view, of course, in that organisation.
So it's an expensive, the larger ones are using the high cost route there then basically, and you know, you're paying to recruit the right people, you have to pay them a decent salary to get the person who comes in and fits straight away, whereas the smaller and medium ones, which is interesting, I do always think that people in a smaller or medium business, you get a greater breadth of skill anyway, probably because you get more exposure or your job is broader, but so they're actually moving them around more so potentially. Interesting. I don't know whether there's any difference in engagement in any of those areas. So it's probably too easy, too early to say.
I guess it's too early to say, but my guess would be that if people feel they're being invested in by their employer and valued enough to be given other opportunities, they're going to feel reasonably good about that employer, as opposed to the knock-on effects I found previously with organisations that tend to bring in external talent and ignore
internal.
It's the internals who get hacked off.
Totally. I mean, I remember one of the businesses I used to work for, people used to say the only way to get an above market rate pay rise was to leave and come back. It's quite common. It was then. And that's and that isn't great for engagement. And I mean, when you look at engagement, actually, it isn't about salary. It's a lot of it is opportunities to learn and grow in a role, which, you know, it doesn't have to be formal training. It can be moving people around and giving them career opportunities and coaching and mentoring and the sense that they are developing within that role.
Exactly.
I mean, moving on to engagement, actually, because we were talking about this earlier, I had going back to my previous world in two large blue chips. So when I was there, engagement was the Gallup type engagement. In fact, we were what we used to run the Gallup survey. And it was very much the argument for paying for that at the time was to do with the fact it was linked to performance, maybe retention, but it was about performance and productivity. It was very sort of financially motivated. And my sense now is that employee engagement, it feels like it's shifted. It's still related to whether people are going to stay and go, just give you the extra discretionary effort. It's still really important, but I feel like it's more about belonging and links into well-being and stuff. That's just an intuitive feel. I just wondered what your view was on that.
I'm very inclined to agree with you, because I think, again, the pandemic has shown very clearly that there are winners and losers in the new ways of working. You know, hybrid working or remote working doesn't suit everybody, and it's available to not everybody if they wanted it. And you've had leaders in particular having to reach people through Zoom and Teams and so on, and show some of their humanity. Because I think that's part of this broader shift towards, on the one hand, consumer or customer centricity that in theory is taking place through digitization and people's expectations of personalized delivery. But the same, I think, increasingly applies to the people you've got in organizations. And, you know, that notion that if you've got people broadly ticking the boxes on, I have a best friend at work and all the rest of it, you're going to automatically get higher productivity. Whilst it's the previous business rationale, I think now the issue is more to do with, you know, the environmental, social, governance factors, you know, around can we be not only capable of surviving as a business without the people to deliver the service if they're all off sick? And clearly we've seen, no, you can't really, especially if you can't get replacements. But there's also that ethical issue that is more and more important, which is a bit ironic in a period where broader politics here and on the other side of the pond There are ongoing debates about ethics and trust and so on. And I think that has percolated through to the workforce. People want to feel that they're valued, that they're doing work that is valued, and the thing they're doing is valuable and has some sort of end user or some higher purpose in mind. And sometimes, you know, the shareholder purpose is not particularly motivating unless you're paid such shed loads of money for thinking only about trading.
Profits, or, yeah.
That in itself can be motivating, but for most of us, it's much more a broader range of purposes, but particularly the idea that you're serving somebody else or you're helping somebody else, if you like, the customer purpose. In the public sector too, I'm not talking about customer in a, you know, just private sector scenario. That for me is one of the main ingredients of an engaged workforce, to their own cost in some cases. So it is a bit of a circular situation we're in at the moment where, for instance, in the NHS, you've got people who do believe in looking after their patients, who try their damnedest, in some cases have died as a result of that. And yet they're having to keep on going and keep on going, even though they're worn out because there aren't enough people to replace them. And that's where eventually you fall out of love with what you're doing because you can't do it to your satisfaction, and it's that thing about
it's going to break you. That's the problem, isn't it? Especially the resource issues.
Yes, and you'll fall out of love with the organisation as well because you'll see it as letting everybody down. You know, so that's where I think the well-being link with engagement is very much of the moment, and I hope it will last more than you'll get more performance out of people, because you can do that till the pips squeak, but then you've got no lemon left.
And
that's where people would become very cynical about attempts to motivate them through, let's do some sort of happy clappy type, you know, team building thing, and if their individual needs have not been recognized, and if in practice leaders and managers don't care. So I think that notion of you can't mandate people to care, but I think line managers in particular need to support teams who are going through difficult times.
And they probably should have always done that. But that's the interesting thing about as suddenly many of us working remotely is all of a sudden you are seeing in people's homes and having conversations, this sort of authentic leadership, let's just say, which was a buzzword before. It's about being your authentic self, whether, you know, whatever your role is, you know, whether you've got cats in the background or, you know, there's a whole sort of the pretense almost, or the facade that we had of like going into work, that's kind of dropped. And I don't know that people would want that to change. And therefore we've got to connect with human, the whole leadership, well, it's our fourth point actually, leadership style, this humanity, being able to be a human with people, feels that that's got to continue to support this newer style of employee engagement, which is less about how hard I can work, and it's more about I need to feel belonging, I need to feel understood, I need to feel that you're going to develop me in line with what I want. And that might not be being in an office 5 days a week, that might be, you know, work-life balance, and, you know, there's a whole host of things that people now want in terms of their psychological contract, and we've got to try and juggle that as leaders. Quite a complex, I think, if we ever thought that maybe this is, that if we talk about our, in the UK, the people management piece, one of the things I've often talked about, and I've done quite a lot of leadership training over the last couple of years because people have been doing it remotely, which is quite nice, because all of a sudden people went, do you know, I've not trained my managers ever, because there's lots of things they've never given them training, and now they really don't know how to manage, because you put in a remote environment is even harder. And I'm just interested, where do you think we should go with leadership development, leadership styles, and those sort of things?
Yeah, well, as you said, you know, the whole scenario's in motion. I agree with you fully that what we need to hang on to and develop further is the more human styles of leadership in almost every sector, and You can be, you know, senior vice president of a major corporation, but you still need to be a person who can connect with other people and help create the context where they want to give of their best.
Yeah.
We've seen some great examples of that in the last 2 years because of the situation we've been forced into over Zoom and Teams and so on. And the challenge will be going forward for leaders to be able to create that same sense of solidarity and transparency up to a certain extent, at least, you know, be willing to show their vulnerability, but be genuine about it.
Yeah, don't fake it.
To break down the barriers between people, but the challenge will be more complex because with the so-called future of work, you're going to have some workforces totally remote, others half in, half out, others working on combinations. So it's learning how to communicate with people in a variety of different ways, and also what to communicate as well. I mean, I don't mean having a script. I'm talking about when is it important to make a simple comment on something that's happening right now, rather than wait 3 weeks before the report is out. And I don't mean that all senior leaders have to become experts in all the various platforms, social media platforms or whatever, but there is something about thinking about how do you send messages, but also receive messages and show that you've received them. And in some ways, act on some of those messages so that people feel this is a genuine person and a genuine communication, and I can trust this person, because there's so much ambiguity and uncertainty, even though we might try and say, well, it is a period of growth, yippee, let's on with the mockery. It's still very uncertain. People are often struggling with their own finances and other things. They've got things on their mind. So they need somebody as senior leader and senior leadership who can show some empathy, but also be honest with people. And as I say, have proper conversations that actually lead somewhere. Same is true of more junior people in more junior leadership roles, anybody managing a team or, you know, managing a chunk of the business. Needs to be able to personalize, not to the absolutely every individual, but to be aware, have the finger on the pulse of how people are feeling, what the mood is, what's going on. HR can, of course, help with that big time. And maybe some of these people need coaching, just as you were saying, in how to, up to a point, you know, they don't all have to be screaming extroverts, but, you know, if you are naturally very introverted and you prefer dealing with people remotely, you're going to have to move out of your shell a bit to be able to connect with most of your workforce. And that is really important. And the other point is that in today's world, it's not anyway people just in formal leadership or line management roles that we're talking about when we talk about leadership. It's kind of everyone really. In this era, we need everyone using their initiative, knowing what's going on, the limits to their own empowerment, but pushing beyond, thinking of the dependencies that they've got around them. And, you know, HR can do so much to help with that, you know, bringing people together, peer groups to discuss X or Y, or to share learning over here. Endless ways in which HR can help with all that. It's about building a community where people do feel that they
keeping people talking and keeping them. I mean, that's, as I guess I'm mindful of time, so I don't want to overstep our availability, but I suppose just summarizing, perhaps that's a good point for us to close on that whole idea there about how other things that we can do over and above. I mean, we've talked about a lot about things. We've talked about, you know, technology, let's use it strategically, let's go beyond the admin piece. We've talked about focusing in maybe on the bit of the talent agenda that's going to be most helpful to our organisation long term, whether it's about acquiring talent or it's about retaining talent. So if you've got a leaky bucket, it's all very well recruiting, but actually let's look at how we retain it. That probably does link into our third and fourth point, which is engagement and leadership style. If you want to retain people, We need to think, do they have a sense of belonging? It's not necessarily as simple as have I got a best friend, as you say. You know, it's thinking about what does engage, drives engagement. Let's use engagement survey data. If we have AI data, brilliant, but let's use any data we have intelligently rather than just see it as a benchmark. And then leadership styles, let's develop all the way up and down the organization human leaders there. And that point there, whether it's introvert, extrovert, the whole point about what we could also do on top of all that, because, you know, in the context of people with increased social anxiety, and perhaps as we've got safe working in our little home offices, introvert or extrovert, people have become a little bit institutionalized almost in our safety of our home environment. So how do we make sure that people, the novelty's worn off, right, of the Zoom bingo every week, hasn't it? So how do we get people to have genuine collaboration, innovation and interactions and networking in this more hybrid environment? That's something else that we could facilitate using technology as HR professionals. Thank you so much, Linda. I don't want to cut you off there. If there's anything else you'd like to add, please do feel free to mention it. So I thought that was perhaps a nice way there. You're talking about HR could collaborate, encourage collaboration further.
Yeah, no, I just like to wish anybody in an HR role, whatever speciality or, overall with that people responsibility, the very best of luck. And be confident that you're going to make a real difference if you can make some space to lift the nose from the grindstone and get those conversations going.
That's the key, isn't it? Being able to look up, because people are so busy, and you started by saying HR departments are so busy. So sometimes when you're busy, having the time to be strategic is difficult. So how can we try and carve that time out to drive things forward? Because actually what we're saying here is, well, it is such an important role in terms of taking businesses forwards, going forwards over future years. Linda, I think you said LinkedIn's the best way for people to, if they want to link in with you, to look you up. I'll put any links to your profile on the website. But I just wanted to thank you so much. Sorry, would you like to say that yourself?
No, I just said thank you. That's great.
No, thank you. I really appreciate your time today. It's been a real luxury, pleasure to meet you in person, remotely, the new kind of meeting in person. And thank you so much for being our guest on the 150th HR Uprising episode.
My pleasure and my honour. Thank you very much, Cecilia.
Thank you.
I really hope you found this week's episode useful and enjoyable. If you did, perhaps you could recommend us to a friend or colleague, or give us a review on your platform of choice. It really helps new listeners to find us. Now, you can access links to any of the information mentioned in this show via the website www.hruprising.com. Further free resources are also available at www.actus.co.uk. There you can also find out more about our software and training solutions. Finally, why not join our LinkedIn group, the HR Uprising, to share ideas and collaborate with other like-minded people professionals. Thank you for listening to the HR Uprising podcast.